Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, 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 I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much, Michael H. Price. I appreciate the introduction, as always, and want to remind everyone, in case they don't know, I don't know how they could escape if they're listening to this podcast, then obviously they're people of discriminating taste, but Michael Price is the man behind the Forgotten Horror series, the longest-running series of film commentary books, I guess, in history, right, Michael?
As far as I can tell. Yeah. I mean, uninterrupted streak since 1979, so...
Right.
Yeah.
And also the Comics from the Gone World series, which is a pretty, about as long as existentialism has gone, I think. I think you've outlasted John Paul Sartre on that one.
Yeah, still take the inspiration where you find it. I love crackpot philosophy.
So what we're talking about tonight is especially, I think, different because we watched two different versions of the same picture. Now, the picture that I have that we're talking about here is A Day of the Nightmare, starring actually three pretty good old to middle Hollywood types in John Ireland, of course, who that same year, let's see, he made something else. That same year he made I Saw What You Did for William Castle.
And,
did you know he was Tommy Noonan's half-brother?
I did not know that either.
That's just research in action. But also John Hart, who was a Lone Ranger for a year while Clayton Moore was undergoing his contract disputes and wanted more money, and Elena Vertigo, who was only
the lovely Elena,
from House of Frankenstein and Frozen Ghost, and who just a few years after that started a really good career run in Marcus Welby, M.D. as a supporting player.
Yeah. An amazing player and long on the map.
And so what we've got here is a situation with three Hollywood, well, B stars, I guess, B-level stars. And I don't think they knew that they were doing a skin flick, at least in one of its incarnations. Now, the incarnation that Joey and I have seen is the one I think we got it off of. Joey, are you here? I think we got it off of where did that come from? Netflix?
No, I think it was Amazon.
Yeah,
and it essentially is one in that run after Psycho, that run of psychological horror pictures, which were a little like the slasher pictures and later on the erotic thriller pictures. You didn't have to have too many people in it. You didn't have to have too many sets. You didn't have to have elaborate makeup. And so it was especially attractive to low-budget filmmakers.
You bet. Mm-hmm.
But there is absolutely no skin. I mean, it's got a kind of a weird, perverse thing, but it's more homicidal than it is psycho, if you will.
Yeah, the kind of a gender confusion thing.
Yes.
That would have been shocking in the day,
which is 1965.
Mm-hmm. But how many times? I think most people today would probably see that coming a long way off if they were watching this picture cold.
I think they probably would have too. But in its the form that we saw it, it's essentially just one of those psychological thrillers with a few characters and people acting kind of weird until the big revelation near the end. And so then what was the version that you saw?
A lot of I guess you could call it softcore.
Mm-hmm.
That was the version that I believe was put together for the grindhouses
mm-hmm.
after the fact.
after the fact. In other words, after maybe it had had a run or
right, yeah. and some sub-distributor picks it up and takes it into the cutting room and adds gratuitous quasi-pornographic footage.
Well, you look at the people that are listed there in the credits. That's what that kind of hit me to this in the first place. I was studying the credits in preparation for our Yak Fest here, and
yeah.
I saw Bambi Allen. I saw D. Lockwood. I saw Foreman Shane. I saw Liz Renee. And it's all these people that are in this alleged party scene, and I thought, gosh, these are all people that Dave Friedman worked with and all these. And I never saw a party scene in the film that we saw. So that's why I knew something was up.
And they're not really, let me check a formal cast list. There mm-hmm. is not in the principal cast, of course. It's gratuitous fix-up for the Grindhouse crowd.
Well, I'm wondering, there was an alternate title that I ran into called Don't Scream Doris Mays. And I'm wondering if that maybe it was the title of the Grindhouse version.
That could well be, but the Grindhouse-like version I saw who still has the original title.
Oh, it really does. Okay.
So what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Well, the guy had Jonathan Crane, who was basically a TV actor, who plays the role of the husband in it. He had to have known. Didn't he have to show up in the skin flick footage, or did he not?
I don't recall him placing prominently. I think it's all achieved with cutting.
I see.
Intercutting.
So that
and
yeah.
the what I would consider the newer footage really doesn't match aesthetically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like it was done at a different time and in a different place.
Right. And kind of like that patch in footage on They Saved Hitler's Brain.
Right, and many others.
You've got
yeah.
a very professionally shot basic picture, and then you've got this pretty amateurish additional footage.
Well, you know, it reminds me, I was talking to Joey before we sat down to do this tonight, about films that has happened to, and there's been a lot of them. I was thinking about a film called Love in 72, which William Mishkin distributed, another 42nd Street guy, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off with this orgy scene, and in the middle of the orgies, one of the characters asks another character, say, whatever happened to so-and-so? He says, well, don't you know about his story? And they cut to a completely different film, which is this heartfelt little anti-Vietnam war film that I'm sure this guy sold to Mishkin, and Mishkin immediately took it and cut it up and added all these skin scenes to it.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm just wondering if that's the same thing that happened to Day of the Nightmare.
There are distributors and sub-distributors who are just not that ethical about keeping a film intact.
I would think William Mishkin was one of those, too, wasn't he?
Well, William Mishkin, plus the fact that they had an unfortunate choice of distributor in Kenneth Hertz.
Oh, is that who? Was that Hertz Lion?
Hertz Lion,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's... you get hooked up with people like that, and you're pretty well assured that your picture is not going to get... Even if it is made with a certain dignity, as I believe this was, it's not going to get the kind of audience it deserves.
Right.
I mean, not to say that a William Castle-styled shockeroo is going to is going to merit the art theaters, but certainly, if a picture is perceived to have an afterlife with the trench coat crowd.
Right, right.
Then why not just make pictures for that crowd and stop tampering with stuff that has a bit of a pedigree?
I suppose because it's cheaper to pick up the stuff with a little bit of a pedigree and just add a little bit of footage to it.
Of course,
perhaps,
it is. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I have tremendous respect for the grindhouse trade as long as it is made with that intention.
As long as it's honest grindhouse stuff, yeah.
As long as it's honest, un, un, unblushing grindhouse pictures.
Yeah.
Picture like this one, you know, you might as well take Alfred Hitchcock and patch in some gratuitous nookie. You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, now, since I haven't seen this version, and I have to say that it doesn't. The other thing that makes me think this was added on footage is the film itself does not suffer at all without the film without any nudity. It doesn't look like it's been cut up. It doesn't look like anything. It looks like that's the film that they made.
Yeah, it what it suffers from is the kind of a Mondo Cani type intrusive footage.
I see. And is there a lot of it?
Not to speak of. It's all very gratuitous, and it could be removed without it. It could be removed to the betterment of the film.
Right. Well, for those who don't know what it's about, it's essentially, again, it's right in that psychological thriller mode that was started with Psycho in 1960. Now, this is 5 years later. In the interim, we'd had Homicidal, and I remember Rob White telling me about Homicidal, the film that William Castle made, an obviously slavish imitation of Psycho. But he said Rob White, of course, was writing for William Castle then.
Right.
He'd written, what, House on Haunted Hill and The Tingler.
He was quite prolific until the advent of Robert Bloch.
That's right. Well, apparently, according to Rob White, who I interviewed for Fangoria many years ago, the reason that he left the whole operation was because of Homicidal, because William Castle called him in and said, this is what I want in the film, this is what I want in the film, go back and do that. And he wrote it, and then he went out and saw Psycho, and he said it was the same picture. He said he had just ripped Psycho off completely, and that made Rob White mad, and they got crossways. As you know, William Castle was a bit of a character as well, and you know, and then some. But he said that William Castle just basically wanted to rip off Psycho, and a lot of people did. One that we've done on this podcast, Stark Fear, came along about that time.
Oh, yeah, and of course Hitchcock was not above ripping off Castle.
No, well...
I think Psycho would not have existed without the influence of William Castle.
And tell us more about that.
The attitude of a film that is designed to terrify you, and we dare you to see this. And, mm-hmm. and there's even a Castle-like gimmick in the original release of Psycho about no one admitted after a certain point.
I think in the last 10 minutes, isn't it?
I believe that's right.
I believe that is right.
That would have been beneath Hitchcock's dignity at one point. But you consider that he had intended Psycho to be a two-part episode on his weekly teleseries.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And began to realize that we'll never get away with this on TV, so we'll have to. And Psycho is a very low-budget film for both Hitchcock and Universal Pictures.
It is. I wonder why it got the green light then in the first place. Just it wasn't going to cost them much if it was an experiment that didn't work, right?
Because the studio saw how much money Castle had made on films like Macabre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's even a similarity of title. The Bloch novel Psycho has really no resemblance to anything William Castle did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Up to that point,
right?
The adaptation for the Hitchcock film of Psycho has distinct resemblances to the Castle attitude.
You know, I never thought about that before, but it could almost be a Night Walker or something like that, couldn't it?
Sure, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so one feeds off the other, and then there's this whole who's the real master of suspense around here.
Right.
You know, I mean, the idea of Castle introducing his films, appearing in the trailers, the whole, kind of like a weird symbiotic relationship.
Well, there
I don't
is,
think
yeah.
they weren't, you know, I mean, they weren't associates,
mm-hmm.
but they were contemporaries. And they both were going after the same audience for a period there.
Well, you know, that's right. I guess that's absolutely right. And it was the thriller audience, wasn't it? The psychological thriller audience.
Right, yes. I mean, Hitchcock before Psycho, I wouldn't say better, but his work was more calculatedly artistic.
Yes.
Psycho is not an inartistic film, but it also has elements of the exploitation film that Castle championed.
It sure does. It absolutely does. And it was starting with the black and white, right?
Yeah.
Being shot in black and white, which was not really Hitchcock's M.O. up to that point.
No, not at all. He outgrew black and white about the time that the Hollywood establishment was going for all sorts of elaborate color processes and widescreen gimmicks and what have you to court the audience away from television.
Right.
And so, you know, it's of course Hitchcock was perfect for black and white, as we've seen on the long-running television series.
And was that series his involvement as a personality in that series rather than behind the scenes? Do you suppose that was also one of the driving forces that he was in, for instance, the Psycho trailer and became more of the personality like William Castle?
Oh, yeah, and certainly Castle sees Hitchcock hamming it up on TV, and I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and plus I've got a great big cigar here.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that brash Carnival Spieler personality.
Right.
And it made a perfect match.
Well, I remember the two trailers for Psycho and then a year later, I guess, Homicidal, and both of them are hosted by their producers. Castle and Hitchcock. And that may have been the first time, now that I think about it, that may have been the first time that Hitchcock actually narrated his own trailer for one of his pictures.
I think that may be the case. I'd have to go back and look that up. And then you look at the trademarked caricatured image of Hitchcock, the profile.
Yes.
And Castle, the seated profile silhouette in the director's chair.
That with a cigar.
Gesturing expansively.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, there you go. And do you have any idea how they regarded one another?
No, I don't. I've never spoken. I knew Castle when I was a kid, and I really wouldn't have had the background to quiz him about that.
Yes.
in those days.
Right.
I've never run across anyone who could speak to that, but hey, you know, no better time to start looking.
Yeah, well, circumstantial evidence would indicate that they were very aware of one another when all this was going on.
Definitely, and they had studios in common. They had audiences in common,
mm-hmm.
and they had that whole, once again, who's the real master of suspense?
Right. And again, this was the psychological thriller thing, which, like the slasher pictures and the erotic thrillers, you can have a small cast. You don't have mm-hmm. to have much makeup. You don't have to have very many sets. It's very economical to make a psychological thriller. And of course, I would even and you're very familiar with this picture, but I think in that whole psychological thriller thing, I would also put A Carnival of Souls.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. That's with the ghostly essence, but basically it's a stalker melodrama.
It is. And how, by the way, is that available right now from you, from Cremo Studios?
You mean the Carnival of Souls book?
Your book, yes.
Oh, yeah. It's a brand new edition, in fact.
And I have seen the fan letter that Stephen King sent you about that book, too, by the way. I know we're not supposed to be plugging stuff yet, but I just... It's a great adaptation that you and Todd did of that,
film. Todd Camp and I had the permission and the participation of Herc Harvey, the director of the film.
Right.
And Herc not only provided us with his master elements video dub for reference, but also a copy of the shooting script and a copy of the cutting continuity.
Oh, my.
Which differs quite a bit from the original script.
Right.
And then, of course, we added some touches, and you know, I go back and look at it today and says, gosh, I just thought of a new twist we could have added, and of course, nah. But we did do an expanded edition, an omnibus edition, a couple of years ago, and it seems to be clicking right along.
Was that one? Did you have my story in that one, or is that in a different one? My no longer welcome.
I think that's in.
I think
one
that
of
may
the,
be in. Fish Head, maybe? I can't remember.
I believe it is in. I'll have to dig that out. Yeah. When you crank so much stuff out as we do, it's hard to memorize everything.
It is, but we just know it's somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And would you put the what has become known very cuttingly as hagsploitation or old girl horror? You start thinking about this whole psychological thriller thing, and along comes Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Oh yeah.
In 62 as well, the same year as Carnival of Souls and even Stark Fear. And I'm just wondering if that belongs kind of in that whole canon of psychological thrillers.
Well, you know, I mean, who's the real villain in Psycho? It's a creepy old woman.
That's right. A creepy old dead woman.
Dead woman.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, she's dead.
Yeah.
That's right. One of the things that I found out, and we should probably do just a brief synopsis of what happens. We have a couple, and he's always out, and I think this was shot around San Diego because they're always talking about going to La Jolla and going from La Jolla to L.A., so I feel sure it was shot in San Diego. And we have John Ireland as a tough-minded cop who's trying to run down a murder that happens in this, an alleged murder that happens in an apartment complex, and his trail leads him to a woman. Her name is Barbara Crane in the film. Her name was really Beverly Bain, and I can't find any other credits that Beverly Bain made. She was pretty good.
I'd say she's good.
Yeah.
Why not a larger career? I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't even find an alternate, you know, an alias. Right?
No, I can't either. And there's some weird little touches in it. There's what I guess we would call today a fundamentalist police lieutenant in it who's always speaking in sort of quasi-biblical terms.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got that. And it turns out that it's very much like Stark Fear and like Homicide. It has elements of Stark Fear and Homicidal in it.
Yeah.
The whole idea of the woman, the wife, and she knows that her husband's weird and she's not really sure quite what he's doing. And then their husband has a father who is a psychologist, played by John Hart, the former Lone Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And he tries to help. And before it's all over with, there's a lot of murder and mayhem and weirdness in the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
These psychological horror films, to me, always showed you that you could get a great scary effect without a lot, by suggestion. You know, without a lot of blood and guts and stuff.
You talk about the psychological chillers. I mean, Hammer films in England made as many or more of those as it did the Gothics during this same period.
Boy, you're right. I never thought about that. What was the one with Oliver Reed that's so crazy? When the mask, where he's masked and he sort of jumps out, there's a big jump scare in that one. It scared me to death
gosh.
Back in those. What is the
name? Yeah, caught me off guard.
Caught me off guard, too.
Not Stark Fear. Let me see.
It's one word. It's like Homicidal, but it's not
like
Homicidal.
Yeah, that was a...
I rented that once for a Halloween show at Oklahoma State University. We were trying to raise money for something or other, and that was when you could only rent 16-millimeter films back in the day, as the kids say. And it's right on the tip of my tongue, and I cannot remember the name of that film.
Amazing body of work that Hammer put together there. I always, of course, associate Oliver Reed with The Curse of the Werewolf, but there
right.
are so many more.
This is like,
so many more.
Yeah, this is like 65.
Paranoiac is the one I'm thinking of.
That's exactly what it was.
Right.
And I did a little research on the director of this picture, John Buschelman. Now, he was mostly an editor. That was what he was known for. But he has a long relationship with Bird Eye Gordon. He was the associate producer of King Dinosaur, one of Burt's very early pictures. Earliest.
Sure.
I thought it was his first, but I think it's his second.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he did Picture Mommy Dead as the editor, Village of the Giants. He did Tormented, a great little picture that's very underrated, I think. And he did Bird Eye Gordon's one foray into the X-rated realm, softcore X-rated film, How to Succeed with Sex.
Oh, yeah.
And he also directed that weird little picture that was called Cruisin' High back in the 70s, also called Cat Merkel and the Silks. Mm-hmm. And it was a juvenile delinquent, like gang picture.
Right.
And he did, but mostly what he did, he directed that, but he didn't direct much else besides, he directed a few other pictures, but Day of the Nightmare was, and Cat Merkel and the Silks were the two that probably his two most prominent directing roles. I don't know much about him. Do you?
Not that much. No, mm-hmm. I honestly hadn't. Not the sort of thing I often think about until we come up with an out of the blue title like
that's
this.
That's true.
And of course, that's the contrary to popular impression. We don't walk around knowing it all every moment of every day. We gotta look things up just like everybody else.
No, appearances to the contrary, we do our research.
And,
we actually spend a little time doing that. We also must mention Ted Michaels as the director of photography here.
Oh, yeah.
And now you have dealt with Ted Michaels, have you not? Or was he
to an extent. Just mm-hmm. Nothing extensive, but, how can you resist an interest in the guy?
Now, who was Screen Group? Did you say that was Hertz Lyon under another name or what? Screen Group
was an affiliate of Hertz Lyon, in that Hertz Lyon used them as a source.
Oh.
Governor Films did a secondary release.
So explain.
Oh,
it did. Governor Films did. Now, was that the same version, do you think, or was it this adulterated version?
The print I saw had no
distributor.
No distributor. I'd have to go back and look if I missed something there, but it certainly didn't have the Hertz Lyon logotype.
Okay. All right. So Screen Group Inc. is what's on the one that I saw. Screen Group Incorporated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know who that was, but you say it's basically
a
Hertz Lyon.
That's the one lung production company.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, the one that you've seen, would you, for our listeners, would you recommend it?
Only under conditions where you can't get the genuine article.
Okay, and you think the one without the sans the skin would be a better deal?
Oh yeah, it really diminishes the emotional impact of the film.
Okay, all right.
It's like, why am I watching this film? Not for that. Not now.
No. Not here.
You know, it's just it diminishes.
Well, I must say that it holds up very well without any of that. It holds
sure.
up and fits right in that little canon of psycho, homicidal, stark fear, and many others. It fits right in there without any of the skin, and I think it's fascinating. You know, sometime, Michael, we don't have enough to do, but sometime wouldn't it be interesting to do a book on films that had been done like that?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just to see what we could come up with, where things were. Joey was telling me about one, which you've probably seen. I saw it when I was in the service. I think the word is ingenue, Her Descent into Perversion,
with
Christopher Lewis as the Marquis de Sade.
That's right.
That's right.
The great coverage on that in a sleazy little international magazine called Continental Film Review
back in
the 60s.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a good magazine to find rare stills from obscure, weird films.
Well, Joey claims, or that Christopher Lewis, that's Blood Cult, an entirely different deal. Christopher Lee claims that he had no idea that all of that nudity nonsense was going on, and they were shooting him mostly in close-up. And have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't, although I know that happens frequently.
With Jess Franco?
Oh, yeah, exactly. happens with Zalman King.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think I would recommend, it's got a couple of really unsettling moments in it, and I think I would really recommend Day of the Nightmare. John Ireland is always good. He's good in everything that he does, I think. And and it's nice to see Elena Vertigo and John Hart, but it's also, there's a couple of very creepy scenes in that picture. And
it's an interesting take on how far would someone go to achieve vengeance.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And just a weird kind of vengeance, too.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll point them that way, and we'll want to also plug what you've got out right now. We did a little bit of that, but why don't you let the folks know what they might be able to find on the Michael H. Price front this time?
Oh, well, the new title is Forgotten Horrors, Volume 10, which kind of breaks the continuity of the series so far, and rounds up a bunch of magazine articles and film festival program books and things like that that have never been reprinted anywhere, much less collected.
And your comics mix stuff, too, which I'm really enjoying. I'm in the middle of that right now.
Oh, yeah, the complete run of a long stretch of weekly columns I did for Mike Gold's Comic Mix Company back when that was right on the point of breaking out. And didn't quite get as far as I needed it to for my own stuff, but we had a good run of weekly columns there.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll be darned, these things would fill a book. Okay, let's do it.
Well, you know, the shock theater stuff, which you visit a couple of times in the book, I really enjoy, and I think any monster kid out there would really enjoy that. And actually the whole book, because one of the great things about your books is that you take us into some places where we didn't think we were going to go when we bought the ticket.
Oh, yeah.
That's always a nice thing.
Probably the weirdest thing about Forgotten Horrors Volume 10 is that it also represents a collaboration with Van Cliburn.
Yes. Will you want to go ahead and explain that a little bit?
Van and I worked together to produce the 2001 Cliburn Piano Competition.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he wanted to do was have a parallel film festival showing movies about the piano, classical piano. And so I said, okay, let's do The Soul of a Monster. There's a Franz Liszt in the soundtrack. Oh, no horror movies. So I sneaked some, you know, and of course, you know, the lives of the great composers are often psychological horrors in themselves.
They certainly are.
So I got away with a lot, and then we got a good festival out of it. And the book was, the program book was published and went promptly out of print.
There are probably
some copies of the original printing kicking around at the Cliburn Foundation, but quite interesting. I'd known Van for a long time before we started working together, and it was very persnickety fellow, but good to work with.
So do we want to give any kind of a hint about what we're doing with Volume 9 and the other book that has
That'll get back to the normal Forgotten Horrors continuity pickup in the early 60s and carry it as long, you know, maybe, 300 pages beyond that, and then spin off the interrelated beach party films into a book of their own.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You know, you were kind enough to have me to come aboard, and I've been able to help a little bit with some of the other Forgotten Horrors down the line, and you were kind enough to ask me to do this one, and I think you wanted about 7,000 words on the beach party movies as fantasies, and I sat down, and when I got up, I had 19,000 words, and so now we have another, I assume we're spinning that book off, right? I mean, there's not going to be any beach party content to
It'll
Forgotten
be
Horrors
referenced.
9.
It'll
it
be
will
referenced.
Be referenced, okay,
but
good.
Not necessarily indulged in to any great extent, not when we've got a whole, you know, it's like a conjoined twin. We
it
figured
is.
Out how to do a decent removal.
It is. That's right.
Like, yeah, this is quite the big project, and
right.
You know, not to give too much away, but
no.
But there's a huge historical precedent for the beach party craze of the early 1960s, early to late 1960s.
And you're taking it. I started in the 60s. You're taking it way back and kind of joining everything up. I'm going to be really interested to see how it all works out.
No, it'll fit. It'll
make
sense like nobody's been.
Oh, it'll make plenty of sense. Well, I want to plug a book called Homicide Highball that I have out now from Rich Harvey's Press down in Florida, Bold Venture Press. And what it is the original story that I adapted for Dan Turner Hollywood Detective, the made-for-TV movie I did with Mark Singer as Dan Turner back in 1990.
Yeah.
And what happened, Christopher Lewis commissioned this and got the backing, and the people that were backing it said, well, I think we want this instead of, because it's based on a pulp character, as many, many people listening to us now know. But they thought, well, they'd want it in, set in contemporary times rather than in the 40s. And I thought, well, that might work. You got a whole fish out of water thing. So I wrote a script based on Homicide Highball, a pulp story from the 40s. But this was pulled into the 80s, late 80s and early 90s. And I had a heavy metal cab driver in it. And I had all these sorts of things. And, of course, Dan Turner smoked like fish and drank. It wasn't quite the kind of hero that you would have in that particular era. So I finished the story. And no quicker do I finish the script then Christopher says, well, we got other people involved and they think now that it should be a set piece back in the set back in the 1940s. So I had a week to change the script or to rewrite the script, but nobody has ever seen the script that was set in the 1980s. And so Rich Harvey, who I've known, a pulp fan and a pulp publisher for many years, I've known Rich for a long, long time from pulp cons and things, and he asked me if I would consider having him reprint the script. And I said, great. So I wrote an introduction. We've got the script reprinted, and then we've got the original story that was adapted all in one package. I think it's $15, and it's on Amazon.com, and it's also available from Bold Venture Press in Florida, if anyone's interested in that.
Brilliant.
Anything else we need to plug before we say sayonara?
Gosh, I think we've got the bases covered.
I think we do, and I'm so glad this is the first time I think that we have ever watched two versions of the same movie. And I think that just was, I hope that'll be helpful to people trying to decide which trigger to pull. Michael, we'll talk to you next. Oh, almost forgot.
Yeah, shoot.
We're going to try and, matter of fact, Joey and I have been talking, our producer, Joey Hamburg. We're going to get a new one out. Our plan is to get a new one out on the 13th of every month, the New Forgotten Horrors podcast.
Great.
So this one will be coming out, well, I hope, I guess it'll be out on August the 13th.
Great.
That's
great.
Our theory anyway. And so, yes, and so we'll be, that's our plan. People have been asking us. We've actually had literally thousands of people listening to these podcasts. I say literally. I don't know why people say literally. That's a pretty useless adverb. But
it's convenient.
It is
convenient.
It is convenient. But we've had thousands of people who've listened to this podcast, and we really appreciate that. And so we're trying, and a lot of people say, I wish you could do it on a regular basis. Well, now we're going to try. The 13th of every month, there should be a new Forgotten Horrors podcast. We do it, and it's no cost to subscribe. We encourage you to subscribe, and we pass the savings on to you.
Nice work if you can get away.
It is indeed. Michael, we'll catch you next time. Thank you, sir.
Won't be long.
Okay, bye.
Here we go.